And the topic today is From the Trenches, Using Architectural Skills to Increase Solution Adoption Success Rates. And I'm going to ask you who you are in just a moment. We're going to have a little survey go up, but just a short little bit about me and what Metrics Reporting is. We're basically a boutique consultancy. Most of us, we're very small. Most of us come from being CEOs of our other larger corporations and Microsoft partner organizations. And we are kind of in West Michigan, we don't use the word, but in the rest of the world, you would think of us as more of a think tank. And we work mostly with Fortune 100 companies. And we work in the education, healthcare, manufacturing, entertainment / sports, and technology industries, and some financial industries as well. And most of the work we do is private to the customers that we work with, so we don't share names of who our customers are. And we work on innovation and strategy. And I work more on the technology side of creating, realizing innovations and strategies. And that's what we're going to talk about today. So I'm kind of curious who you are. And Joe's going to be putting up a survey. And please fill this out as to what best describes you. And if you're not on here, just pick the one that's closest. And that's going to help me understand how we are in terms of an audience here. So looks, I think everybody can see the survey, can't they, Joe?
I believe so.
Okay.
People are answering it.
Yep, this is looking great. It looks like I'm talking to the right folks because generally we want this to be geared towards all four. Actually, this is geared towards all four of the colors you see there, mostly architects and project development, those who aspire to be architects. This is perfect. So this is exactly who we want to be talking with. And then when we get to my slides again, I'll have a caveat a little bit about the discussion, because a lot of times when we are presented information, there's things that we know, and there's things that we know we don't know. And today's discussion is going to hopefully be about things you don't know you don't know. So that'll be hopefully the value, if you will, of spending your valuable time with me in this discussion today. Joe, can we go to the next survey? And just tell me kind of where you're coming from in your work environments. So we have mostly developing and things. So we've got some, looks like half internal, half consulting so far, and service providers. Okay. Yeah, these surveys are really great. They really help out. It's kind of a virtual show of hands. Okay, well, great. This is going to help me position the material appropriately, and I'm definitely feeling good that this is the right audience. So you may not feel like you're the right audience when we start out, but I'm going to give you a challenge at the end. So, okay, well, let me run to my slides. And basically, the discussion today, I'm going to share with you, this is not me. This represents my son's physiology teacher back when he was in high school, and that was a couple of years ago. One of the things that I really admired about the school my kids went to was we got to meet the teachers every year. This time of year, right now, we'd go on an evening session and get 10 minutes with every teacher. And one of the things that you notice about high school is that the teachers that teach required courses are less enthusiastic than the teachers who teach something a little different. And so if it's like this is State English 101, this is a required course, this is what it's supposed to be, I teach all the things you're supposed to hear, blah, blah, blah. The physiology teacher that my son had basically stood in front of the parents and said, listen, I'm going to be honest with you. This is the most important class that your student, your child, is ever going to take in their entire high school career, because we're going to learn about the body, we're going to learn about how it functions, everything that we learn in this class they're going to take with them for the rest of their lives. And whether or not it was the best class that my kids ever had didn't matter. The teacher believed that it would be. And that's how I'm going to come to you today. You may not agree with me that the tools that we're going to talk about today are going to make that much of a difference in your career, but I believe they will. I genuinely believe that these are things that will change how your architectures are consumed and adopted by the implementations you make with your stakeholders and end users. And I'm confident about that, and I think it's important that you know that I believe this is probably one of the most important things that you're going to take away with you this 6 months. And I think that I'm going to have a question for you at the very end to feed back to me whether or not it really is in 6 months. So the objectives are right in front of you. We want to increase the value of you to your stakeholder, and we want to assist stakeholders to properly align technology to their business goals. Now, that's a lot of mumbo-jumbo that we hear from everybody, but what I want you to understand is I believe that if you take what you do and compare yourself to a commodity resource that's out in the industry, I think these tools are going to differentiate the value that you offer your stakeholders, either your employers or the customers, for those that are in consulting. This material will add value, so much value that it's going to differentiate you from being what I would say just a commodity resource. This is like a very large differentiation factor. And this is one of the things I learned when I joined the boutique consultancy that I'm in. I was missing what we're going to go over today, and that's probably why I'm an evangelist about it, because it's made that much of an impact in the architectures I've done since. The takeaways are going to be four tools or strategy tools and positions of your solutions to get success out of them. And then I'm going to throw in what I call my titanium rules of adoption. So that's kind of where we're coming from. Now, this is head smart stuff. Basically, I'm coming at you from the trenches. I spent about 30 years in the industry now. I've written operating systems. I've worked in aerospace for 11 years, writing systems for aerospace. And about the last 15 years doing Microsoft technology consulting. And everything that I'm going to use as a case study is a real case study. It's really, I was part of it, or one of my business partners was part of it with me, and what we are sharing with you are the actual numbers and statistics of the situations, but not the vendors, not the customers, not their names, who they are. So we had to cleanse that. But those of you who know me will know who they were anyway. Okay, so I just want you to know that I'm not coming at you from a head thinking this is like a book smart kind of thing. This is more from the field. And speaking of the field, have you ever built a technological wonder? Have you ever built a solution but not had it fully appreciated or underutilized tremendously? And what I'm showing you in front right now is who has seen this before? If you've seen it, just turn your little feedback to yellow. It'll kind of indicate that you've seen this before. Okay, this is the octahedral hexapod. Now, this is probably one of the most significant machine tools that's ever been built. I was part of a team that designed and built this. We have a guy that's seen it before. Greg, wonderful. This is using the Stort platform, a platform that's never been used for machine tool before. And in 1994, we won the Product of the Year Award. And this is a significant piece of technology. Four different computers are required to make it run. It's just amazing. But I see way too many people that have never seen it before. So I'm feeling a little small right now. I'm feeling a little humble because here I poured my life into this system with a bunch of other engineers, and nobody's ever heard of it. And think about this, and think about how the software you write falls on the same type of situation. You've put features, you've put blood and sweat into features of software that are often not even realized that they exist. And that's what we want to change, basically, because nobody wants to build a technological wonder to have it underutilized or unappreciated. So what we're going to try to do is create the strategy and innovative skills behind creating your technological wonders, so that they are more heavily utilized. And I think it's really important that everything you do is recognized. So when you're talking about your stakeholders, they're always right. Right? I mean, is that really right? So when your stakeholders come to you and say, I need to build a system that's going to do A, B, and C, you know in your own mind that A and B are possible, C doesn't make any sense, but the customer's always right. Well, actually, we've come up with processes to correct ourselves from that kind of thinking when you think about it, right? We have our methodologies. Who uses RUP, who uses MSF, who uses Agile, who uses Scrum. All of these things have gone into somewhat of iterations. So each iteration, we get better and better closer to the final goal that we want. How do we know our stakeholders are doing the same thing? In fact, have you ever felt that the people that are funding, if you will, the project that you're doing, basically are throwing a bunch of impossibilities out there and they want you to make it possible? That happens. But what's their iterative approach? How do they get back on task? How do they get back on target? And we don't know sometimes. And we kind of get into a quandary of where I don't know that I can build this thing that needs to be built. So what we're going to do is we're going to use some tools that make us better understand and also better communicate to them whether their goals can be met by their own standards. And I think that's key, because while we have our tools, we don't know often what their tools are. Also, we talk different languages, completely different languages. The technology languages that we talk, they get glazed looks on their eyes when we're talking to them often in the meetings. And sometimes the business discussions that they have, we have to really try to understand, but we're not connecting with them. And these are going to help us communicate across those chasms. So in doing that, let's talk about the perfect disaster. When we build a solution that doesn't meet their expectations, the perfect disaster is not technological. It rarely is technological. It more often is created by missed expectations. So what happens is we're in the same room. They say something like it needs to be this responsive. We take that as a metric goal that we have to meet, and we make it respond. But what we didn't catch is when they said it needs to be this responsive, it wasn't anything about timing and handshakes and response time. It was about responsive to the user's needs, more visual, if you will. So there's a miscommunication. And their expectations were that it's going to do this, that when something goes wrong, and ours are that, you know, it's going to perform fast. So how do we get around these missed expectations? Well, we get around them using communication and education. And the key is the perfect disaster, and we're going to go through some disasters that I've been through, it can be avoided. We can really avoid disasters, and I think that's where our adoption is going to be increased, because we're going to not just mitigate, but we're going to completely avoid them because we're going to transfer ownership. And that gets to the next slide, which I think is a key takeaway today. The key is to help stakeholders assume responsibility and take ownership of the solution. And that's hard because our human nature is, I just want to pay the guy to put the wheels on my car. I don't want to have to understand about wheels and brakes and the little sensors that tell me I need air in my tires. Just put the wheels on my car and let me drive away. A lot of times we're put in that situation when we're developing a software solution. The stakeholders don't want to think out the details of what it is they're asking us to do. They just want us to do it. And that puts us in a bad situation because we're not always able to understand what it is that needs to be done because we don't understand the business needs. Further, when we put the product or the technology that we're using, I'm using .NET or I'm using SharePoint or I'm using BizTalk, and I make that the brunt, what happens is then that product now becomes the solution and not the stakeholders' ideas become the solution. We want their ideas to be the solution. So I'm going to throw a couple numbers up. And any idea what these numbers represent? If you want to take a guess, just yell it out. And if anybody's seen this talk before, don't yell it out. These numbers are significant. I was working with a customer a year ago, and they gave me a proposal. And the proposal they gave me was what they considered one of the best proposals they've ever written for a solution they were going to be providing. It was a technological company who was going to be providing a solution. And when I read the proposal, I did a word count. And what happened is I found that 286 times this vendor mentioned themselves or a product, and 217 times they mentioned the customer. So who do you think is taking full ownership of the solution, whether it fails or succeeds? The vendor that's going to implement the solution is taking complete ownership. They're saying, not only do I own it, but I own everything about it, because I've mentioned my name and I've mentioned the product we're going to use more times than I've mentioned you, Mr. Customer. That's dangerous. That's very dangerous, because the stakeholder organization no longer feels the pressure of having to deliver. They've got a product and a vendor that's going to deliver for them because the product and the vendor asked for it. So what I find is that this is more of our world than not, and it's our own fault, because we get excited about the technology. We get excited about what we like to do. We love what we do, the implementation, the design, the architecture, and we often make a mistake of making it about us. And what I found in practice is that when you make it about them, then you're going to find it to be much, much better, because they're going to take responsibility. When it doesn't work the first time, they blame themselves. They don't blame you or the product, but you have to position things up front properly, and then we'll have some tools to do that. And here's our first tool. One thing that you want to do, and this is going to get more into the architectural competencies. If you're familiar with the seven competencies, for instance, of the MCA, what we're focusing on today are going to be communication and strategy, are probably the two competencies we're going to be focusing on. And this is a little bit put offish by anybody that's real more closely to developing, because we're not going to be talking about code. But if I come up with better ways of writing code, or better ways of implementing code, or testing code, or assuring it works, I'm still only ensuring I'm a better commodity. What we're going to do now is ensure that you're a better value, because you're going to connect to your stakeholders at a different level, and this is going to be using the Platinum Rule is one of the first things that we're going to talk about. The Platinum Rule is not too different than the Golden Rule, and the Golden Rule is not really the one who has the most gold makes the rules. It's more the one, treat others as you would have them treat you, or do unto others as you would have them do unto you, if you're familiar with that phrase as the Golden Rule. The Platinum Rule is actually a book that came out. It's a business book, which I never would read, but when I got into the company that I'm in now, my partners basically said, you need to read this book. The Platinum Rule basically talks about do unto others as they'd like done unto them. And when you think about it, golly, yeah, when you're providing a service, if you're an internal IT organization that is a service to the rest of your company, you know, if you use this rule, it really makes a difference. Do unto others as they want done unto them, which means you need to learn the vocabulary that they use. You need to learn the stigmas and frustrations that they have, often with our own organizations, the IT organizations, because sometimes we're viewed as a necessary evil in an organization, and we don't want to be that. We want to be an enabling factor. So what happens is you learn new ways of communicating, and I have references to all the books that I reference for further study if you'd like. But basically, when you're working with your stakeholders, you need to connect with them at their level. It seems like it would be so much easier if they could just connect at our level. And don't get me wrong, my business partner, Bill Guest, he's an electrical engineer. He has, I don't know, 8 or 9 patents. Brilliant guy. But that doesn't make him a software expert. And when he thinks that he can understand technology at the same level of software development, he really can't. I mean, he really can't. It actually is easier for us to learn their business language than it is for them to really understand what goes behind the scenes in a technology development effort. So one of the things that I'm going to be pushing you today is to learning this business language and business acumen. And I say that because it's not that difficult. It's just always been beneath me to do that. I've always been a technologist. I have a degree in physics. Why would I ever learn business language? Well, duh. As soon as I did and I started talking at that level with my CEOs and CFOs, wow, what a difference it makes. So the first thing is to understand, talk to your stakeholders as they want to be talked to. And then the second one is lead and educate warts and all. And this is something that is just totally against the grain of a good technologist. when you're communicating a technological solution, generally we're going to accentuate the positive, you know, and you're not going to spend much time on what it doesn't do. And that's where we accidentally oversell what we can do and what the technologies we're promoting can do. And we don't mean to, but our excitement gets the better part of us. And I'm speaking for myself. If you can align with me on this, great. If you don't, then you're probably a better solution provider than me, which is probably true. But let's look at the Roomba. You know the Roomba vacuum cleaner, right? When I look at the box of a Roomba vacuum cleaner, it tells me all the fantastic things it's going to do. It doesn't tell me about what it won't do. It doesn't tell me that it won't clean the corner very well. It doesn't tell me that when it tries to go from the carpet to the kitchen floor, which is a hard surface, it might get stuck. And it definitely doesn't tell me that it's going to run out of battery power before it gets done vacuuming my floor. Now, if it did tell me that stuff up front, I probably wouldn't buy it. But we're different. We're solution providers. We want to have this open dialogue with the business people. I find that when we share what goes wrong as well as what can go right, we can then strategically choose to do things that we know are going to go right and stay away from things that are going to go wrong. So unlike the Roomba vacuum cleaner, we want to be completely different and share all the things that can go wrong. So here's a case study. This is a financial organization that we built a portal for several years ago in the SharePoint 2007 when it was beta, when it was just being developed and we were part of the TAP. But the interesting story about this, and this is where these strategy tools, when you use them appropriately, you can actually create what I'm going to say, a better environment for success. We went in there, and I went into a situation where a year prior, they had tried a SharePoint 2003 solution, and it failed. It failed miserably. It failed so miserably that not only did they kick the SharePoint solution out of the company, they also fired the CIO. That's serious failure. So when we went in there to talk to them about collaboration, one of the things I did is I just listened to why SharePoint 2003 didn't work. They didn't know what I was going to suggest, but basically they had in their minds a non-Microsoft solution as their preferred choice at this point in time. When we went in there, I listened for an hour, hour and a half of all the struggles they had and trials that they had. And when they got done, I just kind of looked at them and said, well, you barely scratched the surface of what could have gone wrong. And then I gave them at least two more times of all the things that they could have done wrong in SharePoint 2003 to make it even worse. And they're kind of looking at me like, wow, this is like, why are you telling us, like, yeah, let's get on the hate wagon here. And then I looked at them and I said, now, why did you guys do that? Why did you choose to use features that you knew or should have known weren't going to create the solution you were looking for? And I then put it back on their shoulders. I said, it's a tool. Why are you trying to put screws in with a hammer? It's not going to work. Why aren't you using a screwdriver? And then I went into the SharePoint 2007 features, and I showed them everything in 2007 that would work that didn't work for them in 2003, and I showed them all the things in 2007 that could go wrong. from the perspective that this is the right platform for your solution, but it is a tool. It has faults. It's not infallible. It has faults. If you try to do certain things, they're going to go very south on you very quick, so don't try it. Don't try to put 10,000 records in a list. You're not going to like it. Keep the list down small. So these are the things where we shared everything that was good, everything that was bad, and everything that was ugly, so that we would avoid bad and ugly and accentuate the good, warts and all. The openness around that was very well received. Basically, we were telling them, the solution is in your hands. What you choose to do will dictate the success of how this tool is going to perform it, so we have to stay within the bounds of the good. So what did we end up doing? This is what's really great about this project. We added $200,000 more to the budget of the project. Wow, that's crazy. We went in there with a product that had failed on a prior version. Not only did they go buy in on SharePoint 2007, but they added $200,000. And the reason they added $200,000 was so they could do architecture first, governance first, and establish stakeholder ownership. That was very key. When we identified that the failure was not the technology, the failure was their inability to manage a technological solution, we got them to understand that you have to invest. You're going to put a project this large together. You have to invest in your architecture and governance as well as the technology that you're going to implement it with. And that's what we got. So they increased the budget by $200K. They did architecture. We got total stakeholder ownership where the CEO was the first user of the system. The CEO then sent email out to everybody saying, our new system is in place. I'm the first user. I want you all to join me. That's a different positioning, if you will, of the solution than just dumping a solution onto them and saying it's ready to go. Because we had all the stakeholders, the CFO, CEO, CIO, all using the solution before any of the rest of the company, and there were 8,000 people in the company. So anyway, that's an example, if you will, of using education and bringing out what can go wrong as well as what can go right, so that you avoid the wrong and accentuate the right. So that's just one thing. Now, if we want to look at an actual tool to help us communicate these things, one of these things is called an NABC. And the book is Innovation, the Five Disciplines, Designators, or I can't read that too well, for creating what customers want. Another business book. The books that I'm referencing are all business books that my business partners have all brought me into understanding. And what you can do as a technologist is you can adopt this NABC, like, you know, during this phone call. And what you'll find is that you can really use this to communicate back to your stakeholders that you understood what they said. So what I do when I'm working with a customer, I listen to them describe the situation. A lot of times they're going to dictate a product in their description. We want to use SharePoint. We want to create a SharePoint site, or I want to use BizTalk and do a new BizTalk integration. And I listen to them say that, and I throw up all these yellow flags inside my head, and then I come back at them with an NABC, Need, Approach, Benefit, Considerations. This tool is probably one of the two tools. This tool and the next tool are the two primary tools that I want you to take away with you today, to the point that when you're ready to use it yourself, if you want to send me a copy of your own NABC for something you're doing, please do. I'll review it with you and send it back to you. So what is an NABC? Basically, I'm going to use a case study of an energy company that I worked with where we did a BizTalk pilot a year prior to the case study, and it was a successful BizTalk. We replaced TIBCO, and we used BizTalk to do integration to their mainframe systems, and it just was completely successful. Well, based on that success, the company decided to replace WebSphere with BizTalk to do their EDI. Now, those of you that know WebSphere and know BizTalk know that that's apples and oranges. I know the Microsoft people on the call want to say, well, no, we're better than Westfield. Well, yeah, you are in certain things. However, from a business analyst perspective, WebSphere has $1 million tool set. BizTalk has, you know, a $50,000 tool set. The maintenance on WebSphere alone was what justified this project. So what happened was I got in there after the failure. I've done a lot of work in the past making things work after they failed, and this is one of those situations. So what happened was there were 8 developers that I went in to meet with, and they not only didn't like BizTalk, they loved WebSphere, and there was no way they were ever going to adopt BizTalk as their platform of choice. They were being forced to use it. They had a new CIO. The guy was Microsoft positive. He wanted to use the Microsoft stack, and they're like, this is all wrong. So I'm an independent consultant at this point. Well, I'm part of a gold partner, but I'm in there, and I knew the people, their stakeholders, from the year before. So I talked to these guys, and I said, listen, if you really want to go WebSphere, we can do it. I know these guys. They will listen to me. If you want me to go in and, yeah, but you're the Microsoft guy. I go, well, you know, we need to get the solution done that needs to be done. So if you think WebSphere is the right solution, I will go to bat for you, and I will convince them to use WebSphere. And they're like, you'll do that for us. I go, yeah, absolutely. I said, but you got to understand, WebSphere monthly maintenance is 3 times the cost of buying BizTalk outright. So this is going to mean that 7 of you are going to lose your job, but one of you will be around to do the WebSphere. And they all looked at me, and they go, what? I said, well, we got to pay for it. So we're going to have to take 7 of your jobs away to pay for it. But you're going to get WebSphere out of this, so that's what you want. And they go, oh, we're kind of interested in BizTalk now. So you kind of understand, when they understood the financials at play and what was at risk, that creates a better adoption for them. So when you take this and you communicate it back to the stakeholders and to the development team, the NABC is the perfect tool because you identify a need. Notice in everything that we're going to do in this NABC, we never talk about a product. And the reason we don't talk about a product is that 286 versus 257, we don't want the product to be the solution. We want their idea to be the solution. The stakeholders needed a cost-effective integration platform. That was the need. You need a cost-effective integration platform. It doesn't say that WebSphere is bad. It doesn't say that BizTalk is good. It just says we need a cost-effective integration platform, period. That's the need. And then we go to the A, the approach. This is key. This is the biggest key slide in the NABC. Our approach is to recommend a less costly platform and invest in the development team, who admittedly will have to undergo a transition hurdle. This is key because the approach identifies several things. Remember before when we increased the budget by $200,000, this is the ask. This is saying, yes, we can go to a less costly platform. However, Mr. Stakeholder, I need you to invest in your people to get them to a place where they're going to be productive in this new platform. Before I was in there, it just was assumed that you use BizTalk, it's cheaper to use, it works. They never took any consideration that it's going to take at least a month for their people to get comfortable with the platform, and probably 2 to 3 months before they're productive in the platform. So in the approach, you make it very specific that there are, yes, cost benefits. However, you need to also put money up front, if you will, money, time, resources up front to invest in your team to understand how to become proficient on that platform. At this point in time, it had never been approached to the stakeholders. They just figured this technology, if you're a Java programmer, you should be able to program in .NET. I mean, I read it in the magazines. Not always the case, especially with BizTalk. Now, for those of you that know BizTalk, you also know that's a little bit more difficult than just generic .NET programming. So there has to be a significant investment in your development team. So now B is the benefit. What's the benefit of me making this investment in my people? The benefit is a 75% reoccurring cost reduction and an elevated, brighter development team who can extend their new skills toward increased value and other solution development efforts. And I should have a poll for this. For those of you that know BizTalk or have worked with that platform, have your .NET programming skills increased or decreased when you use BizTalk? I'm going to guess that they've increased significantly because now you know about the GAC. Now you know about strong name keys. Now you know about a lot of the .NET features that you never worried about before, but now that you know them, you can use them more effectively. So what happens is not only are you going to save money, but you're going to take .NET development resources and make them even more powerful. That's an added benefit. Another thing, they were only looking at the cost before. Now they have a skill increase as well. The other thing is, and I don't have the Gartner study that did this or Forrester study, but studies have, and this is really bad to say when you're doing a presentation, because guys that do presentations always quote studies and don't give reference to them. I wish I had the reference and I don't. I apologize. But if you invest in your people, if you educate your people, they generally take that and look at that very favorably. It really increases, if you will, loyalty and retention of employees. And I really need to look up the study that states that. you can disagree with me, but I think that most will agree. C are the alternative considerations. And this is where you identify for both the stakeholders and the team that's going to be doing the implementation, the alternatives that were considered in this approach. And one is to keep the existing integration platform. It's too costly, and you have to eliminate headcount to do that. Notice we didn't say what it was. We're just saying that we can keep what we got. You know, don't, if it ain't broke, don't fix it, right? But it's costing us too much, and we'd have to eliminate headcount. That communicates then to the people that have to adopt the new technology that the company can't afford what they've got, and if they're forced to, then something bad is going to happen. The other consideration would be to custom develop each integration. So let's say you do have some savvy .NET developers, and I know this from my own experience. I would ask the people who are a little bit closer to development to validate me on this. When you go to something like BizTalk, there's a learning curve. It's a great tool. I absolutely love it. I was a technical specialist for BizTalk, but you have to get over the hump. The learning curve is a little bit steep. Once you get over the hump, things are okay, but getting over that hump is painful. So I would initially say I could just do this in .NET faster than if I have to do it in BizTalk. And at the time I was in development, if my management let me do that, I would make it happen. But they wouldn't let me do that because they needed something that was repeatable and extensible. And that's what a platform generally does, or a framework like BizTalk will do. It creates an environment for repeatable and extensible solutions. So basically, yes, that is an alternative, but it's not the right alternative for this case. So you can see then where this communication tool, and generally you want to write it so it fits on one sheet of paper. This communication tool takes all the details of the situation, pulls out the products, and puts in the real decisions that have to be made and choices that have to be made and fit it on one sheet. And this is something that I'm not comfortable with because I'm totally paperless in everything I do. But my business partners have forced me to do this, and when I do it, it has tremendous response. Is when I present an NABC, I usually present the need, approach, benefit considerations in the slides like you just saw, and then I hand out a sheet of paper when I'm done, and I give the sheet of paper to all the stakeholders in the room. If it's the CIO or the CFO or whoever it is, I give them a sheet of paper that has this here. Two things happen when I do that. One is that's a medium that they're more comfortable with. The other thing is that's a business connection. I'm making a business connection to them because you notice there's no technology discussed in this NABC. It's business approach and business positioning. It's how to use technology. It's not which technology to use. That's key. So actually, it takes you to a new level with them. Instead of you being that geek resource that they only listen to when you're talking technology and they want to hear technology. You've now crossed the chasm over to them and saying, hey, I may not be perfect, but I'm attempting to talk your language to you, and your receptivity, you'll find it to be very high. They actually are genuinely pleased that you're making that approach and that attempt to them. And this is a tool that they may have seen before. There are other tools like Cranfield and so forth that are out there. You could use whatever you use internally in your organization. So that's the NABC. And I guess I didn't think about this, if I should pause for questions at each thing. There's going to be room for questions at the end, and I think that might be the best place for them, because then you can just fire them, because there's a lot of concerns when you're talking about making that initial jump. How do I get an audience with that level of management? I'm not allowed to see that level of management, things like that. Let's discuss that at the end. I think that makes sense, because then I think those are real situations that we need to cover. So I feel like I'm rambling. I apologize. Let's go to the next tool, and this is the strategy map. And the Norton & Kaplan strategy map has been around for quite some time. The Harvard Business Review is a reference that I used, where I learned it from, again, my business partners forced me into all of this. The benefit is, this is one of those situations where you can graphically depict the overall solution from a business perspective. And you can use that to communicate from the C-level management all the way up to the developers that are implementing the solution, so that they understand what the real picture is here. And once again, you know, maybe I'm the only one that's ever felt this way, but when I'm developing the octahedral hexapods, like we saw earlier, it was called a block cycle time, the amount of time we calculate the next move of the machine, and it had to be communicated. And I did the communication interface, and I had to write the protocol that would allow more data to be transmitted in the bandwidth that I had available to me. So to me, this whole project was nothing unless my communication protocol worked. So I was the most important cog in that solution. Well, actually I wasn't, but I was of the mentality that I was. So I had this arrogance that if I don't do my job to the best of my ability, this machine won't run. Well, that's true, but if the guy writing the kinematic equation software doesn't do his job, it won't run either. And the guy running the CNC interpretation logic, if it doesn't work, it won't run either. What happens is we often lose fact that we're part of a team, and the integrations that we have, there is no most important cog. All the cogs are important, and the pulleys and the chains. The strategy map helps create that realism to everybody on the team, no matter where they are. So I'm gonna go through, and we're gonna build one. This is a customer we had. And I want to use soccer as an example. It wasn't a real soccer team, but we were approached by a sports team that they wanted to take the season ticket holders who don't attend. They wanted to take those seats and resell them to fans so that they could get into the games, and the season ticket holders could get reimbursement for the tickets they're not using. And the key is, take advantage of secondary sales at the stadium. Let me put it more bluntly, and I don't want to use an inappropriate language, but basically the gist was, for every butt that sat in a seat, the stadium got on average $16 in concession sales. So for everybody that was attending, they averaged about $16 per seat of revenue. So what they wanted to do is to take 1,000 seats that are empty at a given game and turn that into $16,000 on average per game. And over the course of the season, that would fund creating the technologies and integrations that were necessary to do that. So we worked with the sports team to create, if you will, a VIP-type environment where you could be a season ticket holder for a day. And we're going to build a strategy map together. And this is one of those things where if you just kind of scratch one of these out when you're listening to stakeholders describe what it is that they want you to do, and you just, even on the whiteboard or just on a sheet of paper, shove it back at them and say, this is what I heard you say. Am I correct on this? It really changes their understanding of what it is that you understand. The key here is, it's basically a matrix, and on the far left are perspectives. And when you read the material, basically it talks about the perspectives. You can have as many perspectives as you want. Generally, the default ones are going to be the learning and growth, the operations, the customer, and the financial. For this sports organization, we kind of called it the employee learning and growth, the game, the fan, and the owner. And you're going to build then the strategy of why are we doing this? Why are we going to sell these tickets, and what are all the facets and cogs and things that are involved? And it's very simplistic. And the funny thing is, when I first saw these tools, I just kind of scoffed at them and said, you know, I'm building UML diagrams that are really meaningful, and you're showing me these drawings that are strategy drawings. I can't see how these have any way of communicating to anybody, but they do. That was the awakening that I had. So let's start out on the employee growth. Basically, the perspective is, what do I have to learn to make this thing happen? I need to train my IT team, and I need to build and support some sort of system that's going to facilitate this reselling of tickets. And then I also need to go out and identify which ticket website vendors I'm going to integrate with, because I don't want to take the money. I want them to continue to take the money. I just need to feed them how many season ticket holder tickets I can resell, and then they can feed back to me which ones they've sold. So the metrics we're going to use and the initiatives, they kind of work together to validate that you've met this goal. So we need to go under the initiatives, the tech and tools training. We need to learn the tools that we're going to use to build this. I also need to create a regulatory awareness. I can't just go and sell tickets. I have to do it under strict governance of regulation, both by the teams, the agency that we're working with, and the government, because you can't let people make a profit or else they have to claim it as income. And then there's the technical acquisitions. Am I going to need to buy servers? Am I going to need to buy, better bandwidth? What am I going to need to make this happen? I'll know that I'm successful when my technology people, the developers, the IT support staff, and so forth, are at a level of readiness to make this thing happen. My infrastructure and systems will be built. I'll have the right hardware in place, and there's going to be a strategic awareness by the entire team what this whole thing is about. And that's something that often is missing in our solutions when you think about it. What's the strategic awareness of why are we doing this? So the next level then, we're going to build a ticket resale system. We're going to build a process of reselling tickets, and we're going to have the ticket vendor integrations. We're going to create a promotion site, and we're going to implement a customer interface that's going to make it easy for them to buy these tickets, make it easy for season ticket holders to put their tickets up for sale. And we're going to measure this by how many tickets are posted for resale, and we're going to measure it by how many tickets are actually resold. We're putting in the metrics of success. If we look at what makes the success of our solution, in the old days, we would say the day we deploy is the metric of success. It's a time when we deploy. The reality is not the day we deploy. It's the day we turn profits that from the work that we've done is the real measure of success. It's not just when I deployed, it's when I'm actually benefiting from having the system there. And that's how we measure these. Now we have an actual column that says this is how I know I'm successful. So then what I'm going to do is take us to the next level, and that's the fan and the customer. This is key. I'm going to reduce the number of no-shows because I'm selling those tickets. I'm not making profit on the sale. I'm just getting $15 for every person that's sitting in a seat. I'm also going to grow my fan base because I've got maybe 500 to 1,000 more people attending a game, and I'm going to increase fan loyalty. But here's some other things. Now that I'm an architect, a developer putting this together, I'm going to start coming up with my own ideas. And one of them might be VIP for a day promotion. What if, just to get this thing really kicked off, back in the financial system when the CEO was the first person to be a user of the system, and then he sent out a message to everybody saying, I'm using it, you should too. What if we said from this perspective, you should buy these tickets because after the game starts, one of these seats is going to be promoted to a box seat, and you're going to get to come up to a box and watch the game from a box. that's going to create kind of a lottery, if you will, and get even a further promotion in it. The other thing is we're going to see season ticket holder incentives so that we get the people that have season ticket holders to want to sell the tickets as opposed to just give them to someone else. So we're going to have to create this kind of excitement, if you will, in terms of the technologies we're using. So that might mean we need to bring in a marketing firm to make this thing happen.
Which is generally what we did. And then that takes us to the final perspective, the owner perspective, the financial perspective. We're looking at two objectives here. We want to make money, all right? We want to make more stadium revenue, and I want to get more licensing revenue. Here's the point. We already understood I want to get more money for the butts in the seats that are going to spend the money on concessions, but I also want to get more season ticket holders. You see, if I've got people that are shy about buying season tickets, just knowing that if I can't attend, I can sell that ticket back, that's going to offset my investment. So I can, if I normally wouldn't spend the money to buy season tickets, but I know that if I spend the money, I'm going to get the money back for games I don't attend, there's an incentive, and I'm going to get more client loyalty, if you will, in that revenue stream because season tickets are paid for up front. I get that money early. So it's all about the money. I mean, business is. We can't kid ourselves. But in technology, we don't recognize that all the time. We should, but we don't because our tools and technology are about creating the best technological solution in the right time frame at the right cost. And we don't often focus on the fact of why we're even building the, you know, the Great Wall here or the Great Tower or whatever it is. So I'm just going to flip back. There were questions that were asked at the bottom of these to help us fill these out, and these are kind of nice. What capabilities and tools do the employees need to help them execute our strategy? That's a question that we rarely are asked as technologists. It's key because the business people need to know that we might need something before we can do this. Whenever my wife has me do a project, I always tell her I get a new tool. No matter what the project is, I get to buy a new tool. It keeps the projects from going out of whack, but it also allows me to get the right tools to do the work. So that's basically what we're asking right here. The next question for the operations perspective is to satisfy our customers, what processes must we excel in? Understanding the process of what it is we're doing as opposed to just building a technology. And then the customer perspective, who are the target customers? In this case, the fans. The fans are the target customers. What's our value proposition in serving them? We want to make it so that they want to come to games. And we're going to make it easy for them to get better seats. And then finally, the financial perspective, what financial steps are needed to ensure the execution of our strategy. So this also would affect that I need to invest. I make the right investments to get the right investment out. There has to be a payback period. There has to be a return on investment, all these things, value options, real options valuation and so forth that will help us understand there's real value to what we're trying to do. So this is just a good example then of a strategy map that we used that really was effective. And I can tell you that the sports organization that implemented this has seen the financial benefits. And it was a very good investment on their part. Again, it should fit on one page. You should be able to print this off and you should be able to hand it to everybody in the team on the project. Just like you might have your Scrum list, the list that you're trying to break down and get things done in the weeks of your iterations for development, this should be on the wall of every person on the team so that they understand there is a big picture here. They're part of that big picture. They're an important part of that big picture, but they're a part of something bigger than just a little piece that they're working on. And the little piece that they're working on could be Kingpin, it might be support, it doesn't matter. The goal is the top perspective. That's what we're all after. And this is a good thing to have because you get it on one sheet, everybody's on the same page then as far as the strategy goes. And this is one of those things that everybody from developer to CIO to CFO to CEO can understand because these are the tools that the business people use. And for them to understand UML would be a little bit more difficult than for us to understand the tools that they're already using. So I don't know if this is the first time you're seeing these. Maybe you guys, some of them, you have MBAs or something. I don't. So for me, this was all new, and it was just, it was eye-opening because in execution, I've used this for 4 years now. It's just been tremendous. So that takes me to my titanium rules of adoption. We had the golden rule. We had the platinum rule. Now I'm going to give you my titanium rule. And these are key in that it's about getting what I'm going to say a proper alignment of expectations. The perfect disaster, we talked about expectations. So one is promotion of technology gains you nothing. Business problems are solved by people, not technology. When you state this to your stakeholders and you let them know repeatedly, because they want the technology to solve their problems, we are inherently lazy. There's no question about that. I am. We don't want to have to do work that we don't want to have to do, and we don't want responsibility that we don't have time for. But when you make the solution that they're asking you to build their responsibility, then you're going to share that responsibility with them, and you're going to say that you're the reason this is going to be successful, not my solution. My solution is the tool to bring value to what it is that your vision is. When we get through the first iteration and it doesn't work, because you know generally it doesn't work out of the box, you know, out of the gate when you release, then they can come back and say, okay, I need to reevaluate my strategy, and you're right there saying, yes, once you reevaluate your strategy, my tool will be able to mutate or change necessarily to implement whatever changes we need to make your new strategy the right strategy. Because to us, iteration is part of the process. To them, iteration is a sign of failure. And we don't want them to feel like they failed. We want them to feel like they're open to having that iteration. And if you tell them from the get-go, when we release this thing, we're going to learn things that we didn't know, and we're going to have to change our strategy, and our strategy map may have to change, but the tools that we're building will allow for that. That's a value add that you have as opposed to being a hindrance, and you're not going to be the blame then. You're going to be the solution. So that's my key titanium rule. The next one is time is best spent addressing business problems using generic terminology, establishing stakeholder ownership of the problem and the solution. That's just reiterating what I said at the very end there. You want it to be about them. That's the platinum rule. You want it to be about them. And as long as you can keep at bay what it is, the technology that you're going to use, the platform that you're going to use, keep that at bay. When the technology creates their vision, then they're going to love the technology no matter what. You don't need to sell them on it anymore. I remember 39 manufacturers, this is probably 3 years ago, that I brought into a SharePoint solution. I never told them they were on SharePoint. I just said, we're doing a collaborative solution. You're going to share your information. We're going to have a library. And at the end of the release and the iteration, this is part of it's called a wired grant from the national government. It was an innovation grant. After a year after this was implemented, they were all just going gangbuster on it, and two of the companies that were Microsoft adverse purchased Moss because they really saw the value, because eventually they find out what it is. But when you make it about them and not the technology, the results are always better. Okay, next one is educate, 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 and one more, educate. Problem solving first, then technology. And when you think about it, our problem-solving skills as technologists are generally going to be quite good. That's all we do all day is fix broken things. So I was doing last Friday, my son is at university now, and his roommate was struggling with physics. And because I have a degree in physics, it was thought that maybe I could tutor him in his problem-solving thing. So I spent Friday evening on my whiteboard doing physics problems. And it was great. It was fun. But what you find out is that problem solving comes from identifying what you know, identify what it is you know, and identifying what you need. You do a gap analysis, and then in physics, you look at the equations that are going to get you to what you need from what you know. And you pick only those equations that work, that are going to have the right variables to get you to what you need. And technology, it's going to be the right platforms, compilers, processes, methodologies, etc. We're going to choose, all of them are out there, we're going to choose the right ones to get to what we need. And you can base that on your experience, and you can base that on standards that your organization may have, and so forth. But you have to educate this. You have to repeatedly, in the early stages, work with the stakeholders so that they know that the technology is not the solution, that they are the solution, the technology is the means to their solution. And it has to be repeatedly. They have to be reminded. But through that repetition, you actually win them over, and at the end, game, basically, when things aren't working, they're basically up front saying, yeah, you told me that this wasn't going to work the first iteration, so I'm not surprised. So it's one of those things. If you've ever had your program work the first time you compiled it and executed it, turn your little indicator red. I want to see it. In 35 years, my father-in-law wrote the first, oh, Joe, get out of here. My father-in-law, in 35 years, had one program where, and this was Cardex, he wired a board and wrote the first accounting system for Upjohn Pharmacy, Pharmaceuticals. Upjohn Pharmaceuticals' first accounting system was written by my father-in-law, and he had a Cardex. I'm going to call you to the mat, Garrick, by the way. He had a Cardex that compiled and ran the first time, and the guy that ran the card in the computer, the deck in the computer room for him, gave it back to him and said, McGrain, the first time anybody's ever given me a deck that ran the first try. And that story I hear every time I see my father-in-law now, because he's 79 and he likes to repeat that story. Generally, I'm looking for that, right? I've been in the business 30 years. It hasn't happened for me. So it's just one of those things where we have to really emphasize the fact that things don't happen the first try. It's an iterative process. Stakeholders need to learn that more than we do because we've already learned it. The other one is adoption comes in small portions that grows quickly. One of the things you'll find is that if you take these tools and you use them, you're going to struggle with them the first couple times to get clarity on them. You're going to make them your own, and then the first time you present them to someone, you might get a little bit of struggle or pushback, or you might get a little, oh, that's kind of nice. But what happens is that the adoption is going to grow and grow and grow. And the more you use them, the more you'll find they're expected now because it is an effective communication tool. So what I'm going to say then is that whether or not you can buy into this now, because I've thrown a lot of soft skills on top of you and not as much technology as you normally are hungry for, and I'm normally hungry for, if you buy off that this is something that's worth the merit of trying, bounce it off me first. I have my email in one of the slides, and bounce it off me if you want, because I want our industry as architects to get to the next level. I want business people, if you will, the business stakeholders of an organization to look at architects different than they look at, what I'm going to say, more of the development resources. And I want them to look at architects as really having that business acumen knowledge that's going to make their solution happen. So I'm kind of on a soapbox, but I think you would agree that's going to happen. Neha Kroll, who many of you may know, said engineers ask how, architects ask why. That's a great statement. I really like it, a lot of the stuff that Neha does. The tools that we've talked so far or today are about why. They're all why tools. They're asking the question, why is this important? Why does it matter? And they're not focusing on the how. We have tools to help us focus on the how, but the tools on the why are often a little bit outside our grasp because we just, this is what I didn't know. And when my business partners brought them to my attention and kind of shoved them down my throat, I adopted them and I found, whoa, you know, this is like taking a rose and handing it to a customer. When they see it, they're like really excited. And I'm like, but it's just a simple little diagram. It doesn't matter. It communicates, and it gets you on the same page as they are on. These are the references, the platinum rule, is a good book. You can get it off Amazon. The Innovation 5 Disciplines for Creating What Customers Want is a great book. Excuse me, that's a relatively recent book, too. And then the Norton & Kaplan is a Harvard Business Review download you can get that I think is like $6 or something like that. Definitely worth it. These are things that I didn't know existed in my previous life as a developer or a program lead. And as I got into architecture and had to learn the tools of strategy, these are just great tools to have. And I'd be curious about your feedback as well. So why don't we turn it over now to open mic time and tell me about your experiences. How many of you think I'm all wet? Give me your criticisms. I'm open to this. I mean, this is what, you know, if you're like me, when I first heard it, it was kind of one of these things. I was very, very skeptical about it. So let me know what your concerns are.
Yes, Jim, most of the people are on listen-only mode. In fact, everybody should be on listen-only mode.
Okay.
So if you have a question, a comment, or anything, use your Q&A panel at the top and go ahead and type those in, and we will make sure that Jim gets those, and we'll answer those as they come in.
And then I have an ask. Don't go away. I have an ask. Let me give you my ask while you're typing your questions, all right? Here's my ask. A better metric. Joe talked about a survey, I think, at the end of this, which I want you to fill out. But what we're covering today is your initial reaction is the as-is state, and I want to hear what your to-be state is in 6 months. So what I'm going to ask you is if you would be so kind as try these out, and in a few months, 2 months, 3 months, 6 months, evaluate their effectiveness, and then get back to me. I want to know if it's really helping you out as much as it's helped me and others that I've done this talk with. I did the talk at Tech Ed in Los Angeles. I'm doing it in Berlin in November. I actually had a really neat thing where I had several of the people that saw it send me their strategy maps and NADCs, and I'll evaluate them, correct them, and not that I know the right answer, just give you some suggestions and send them back to you. And I got some really positive feedback, but it's one of those things where this is not the kind of thing that you can flip on the adoption bit. Adoption is going to come over your own experience and time working with it, which isn't going to happen overnight. And that's why this is a difficult talk to make, because it's like an ex-smoker, right? A guy who used to smoke that doesn't smoke anymore is the worst kind of non-smoker. I'm a convert, and I'm very evangelistic about it, but I really respect that not everybody's going to have the same excitement that I have at this point, because I've gone over that hump and learning curve.